and welcome to the Pregnancy Wellness Podcast, hosted by me, Pip, a practicing midwife who is on a mission to provide you with real evidence-based information about pregnancy, birth, and the postpartum. Each episode, I'll be joined by special guests and leading experts to equip you with all the information you need for an empowered journey from conception right through to motherhood. So, with no further ado, let's make a cuppa and get started with today's episode. So sadly, the death of a baby is not a rare tragedy. And every day in the UK, around 14 babies will die before, during, or soon after birth. This means that nearly every 2 hours, a family is faced with the devastation of the death of their baby. There are arguably few experiences that can compare to the trauma of losing a baby. And it's imperative that we break the silence on this issue, that we give bereaved families a voice and banish any taboo or stigma associated with losing a baby. I am honoured today to be joined by Josephine, mum to Oliver, who was born sleeping in January this year. Josephine was faced with saying both hello and goodbye to Oliver all in one day. She is an amazingly strong woman who wants to use her experience to help others. Ever since her tragic loss, Josephine has been passionate about raising awareness around stillbirth and sharing her journey navigating the world after losing baby Oliver through both blogs and social media. I am so grateful that she's joining me on this episode to share her story and to help lift the lid on infant loss. Please note that this is a very emotive subject that may trigger stress or trauma, and I would advise listening to this episode in a safe space with support available. If you are affected by any of today's episode and feel you need support, there are three fantastic charities linked in the description below: Sands, Tommy's, and Aching Arms. So hi, Josephine, and thank you so much for joining me and really being so brave and courageous in sharing your story with infant loss and with baby Oliver.
Thank you.
So can you kind of just talk through kind of your experience and Oliver's story with you?
Yeah, not a problem. So my pregnancy was quite straightforward, other than some quite bad morning sickness, which at the time was quite unwelcome, but I'd probably do anything to have it again now.
Yeah.
I was in hospital a few times with it, but we only told a few really close family and friends that we were expecting to begin with. At 12 weeks, our scan was absolutely perfect, so we excitedly sort of revealed the news on social media to everyone. It sort of, as it approached our 20-week scan, I remember sort of saying to George that I was a little bit nervous because it was the one where everything was checked and would it be all okay? But we both kind of agreed that the 12-week scan was fine, so surely the 20-week scan would be fine as well. But sadly, this wasn't the case. The sonographer at the 20-week scan sort of checked everything, and to begin with, everything seemed fine, and then she moved on to Oliver's heart. And unfortunately, she couldn't see part of his heart that she was looking for. She sort of reassured us that she thought it was just that he was in a difficult position, being a bit awkward with his spine the wrong way. But just to be sure and not waste time, she referred us to the local fetal medicine unit so that there wasn't a delay if there was a problem. I think in retrospect, this should probably have rung alarm bells with us, but we were quite naive and sort of trusted what she said and that he was lying awkwardly. So when it came to our fetal medicine scan, we actually weren't too worried about it. I was a little bit nervous because it was our baby and hopefully there wasn't anything wrong, but not too bad. So we went to the scan and he was still laying awkwardly, so they still couldn't see part of his heart. So they asked us to go back again. And unfortunately, when we went for the next scan, they still couldn't see what they were looking for. So it was at this point that the consultant sort of raised that maybe there'd be an issue, but hopefully he was still laying awkwardly. But just to be sure, she referred us to Birmingham Women's and Children's, because they look at this sort of thing all day, I guess. And again, we were told hopefully he was just lying funny and that more experienced eyes would be able to see what they were looking for. And again, very naively, after a few initial tears, we were reassured that it would all be okay. This was all happening over Christmas, so reassured by what the consultant said, we excitedly finished wrapping our presents and got excited about the fact that Oliver would be here next year and celebrated with everyone and ate far too much like everyone does at Christmas. We even moved house on the 30th. And then New Year's Eve arrived, which was the date of our scan at Birmingham Women's. And I think this was the moment that our lives turned upside down. So I remember the scan feeling like it was taking ages. And after what I think was probably only about 45 minutes, we were asked to go and sit in a room and told that the doctors would be through shortly. In all honesty, that was the longest wait I've ever had. But I remember sitting next to George on the sofa in the room and saying that there had to be something wrong, because surely otherwise they'd have just said it's fine and sent us on our way. Naturally, George tried to reassure me that everything was going to be okay, and they probably just wanted to tell us that. But I'll never forget their expressions when they came back into the room of sympathy on all of their faces. And that's when our world stopped. When they leant towards us and said, with a sort of empathetic expression, "We're so sorry, but we found a problem with your baby's heart." And my world just stopped then. Initially, the discussions were quite positive. The medical team was pretty sure that they'd be able to fix it and it wasn't too serious. They said that he'd need operations when he was born and some time in NICU, but other than that, we should be able to bring him home. And he would need another operation as a toddler, but then he'd be okay. So we were quite reassured by that. And we were told that they'd like us just to return for a second opinion and a growth scan. But because it was over New Year, we had to sort of wait until after the bank holiday, which I think was sort of over a week away in the end. But somehow we managed to throw ourselves into that week. We enjoyed New Year, and we actually went and brought all the stuff we needed for Oliver to put in his room, which I think in hindsight probably wasn't the best thing to do, but we did.
I guess that gave you a way of coping and hanging on to that really important hope at the time, didn't it? Because that week must have felt like a whole year on its own.
Absolutely. I remember both of us saying, like, let's just throw ourselves into this and we'll give him the best life we can and he can have everything he wants and needs. So, yeah, that's why we did it. But and then on Monday, the 6th of January, we went back for our scan. So the first one was a growth scan, and we were told he was doing amazingly, like no other signs of illness or anything. So we both went and stuffed our faces in Costa.
Brilliant.
And felt very optimistic about the echo on his heart, because they were just checking that they'd got the right diagnosis, and surely if he was growing okay, it couldn't be anything too bad. So again, we sat and lay in the same room, watching the same screen and watching Oliver wriggling away. And again, we were asked to go and sit in a room and told the doctors would be in shortly. This didn't worry me too much this time, because we'd already been there, done it, and we were told that they'd discuss a plan. So we were expecting it. And again, the medical team came in with sympathetic looks on their faces, leant towards us, and told us that unfortunately, further scans had shown that our little boy was poorlier than we first thought. And again, just like that, our worlds were shattered. We were told that he was very poorly and was unlikely that he would make it to birth. And if he did, that he'd need operations right at the edge of what the most sophisticated surgeons could do, each of them carrying extremely high risks. And we were told that he may not even make it to full term. We spent a long time just sat in that room talking to the medical staff with our own thoughts as well. And I didn't know what to do but to cry. How is this fair? Why us? I have no idea how we made it back to the car, but somehow we did. And we spent the journey home, a mixture of crying and sat in silence in disbelief. The next day, we began the task of telling our closest family and friends that our precious little boy, Oliver, wouldn't make it. We were both totally blown away by the outpourings of kindness from people. I stopped work and began maternity leave that day, and George took some time off work too. I've no idea how we even got through the next few weeks, other than we tried to keep ourselves busy. On the 24th of January 2020, our precious little boy Oliver passed away. We then came home for 48 hours and began the impossible task of preparing to give birth to him. On the 26th of January, we went into hospital to be induced. I remember on repeat just saying, "This isn't fair." Every time a midwife spoke to me, I burst into tears. This just wasn't fair. I clung on so hard to George and the midwife as they began my induction and burst into tears. They told us it would probably only take a few hours to get me into labour. And at the beginning, everything seemed to go to plan. The contractions started, and by the next morning, I was transferred to the labour ward for stronger pain relief. But that's where the going to plan stopped. In total, I spent nearly 6 emotionally and physically exhausting days in labour. Neither of us really slept, and I remember on night 4 asking for the midwife, and then when she arrived, just bursting into tears because I felt so underprepared for this. It was not the birth I had planned, and I felt totally out of control. And every single one of our midwives were absolutely incredible. On the 31st of January 2020, at 5 to 3 in the morning, our little Oliver Anthony Moxham was born silently. We spent the next few hours cuddling our precious little boy until everyone eventually managed to persuade me that I needed some sleep after such a long labour. So with little Oliver in the cot next to me and George's bed pulled up next to mine, the physical exhaustion took over, and somehow, I've no idea how, I fell asleep. The next day, we made lots of memories with Oliver using our memory box from the Lily May Foundation, including doing his hand and footprints, and we were moved into a family room for some space and quiet away from the labour ward. Coming home without Oliver was nothing short of horrific. I remember just sitting on the floor in Oliver's room, unable to move, because having watched everyone else carry their babies out of hospital, I didn't have mine. And it was nothing short of awful. The next days and weeks were tough, but slowly got a little bit easier as time went on. And then in July, after suffering a miscarriage with our rainbow baby, I was diagnosed with postpartum depression, which in itself has been a steep learning curve for both myself and George, but he's been totally amazing at supporting me. Having lost little Oliver, I felt so scared about entering the world outside that had carried on while ours had stopped. And that's when I decided to start my Instagram. I was keen the conversation around baby loss needed to be started, because as horrible as the conversation is, and as many people would like to ignore it, I really feel that it's something that needs talking about, because tragically, as you said earlier, 1 in 4 pregnancies do end in loss, and those families need to know that they are not alone and that the support out there is for them and for them for the beginning.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing, Josephine. The journey that you have been on, as you have just explained so beautifully and emotively, is absolutely tragic. But the way in which you and George have managed to shape Oliver's memory and create this drive and this passion that I know you've got to try and raise awareness is just amazing. When you're going through this awful grief process yourself and then dealing with postnatal depression diagnosis, which, given what you've been through, I mean, is not surprising at all. So I'm so pleased that you're now kind of accessing the support that you need, which will really help with that whole process. So thank you so much for sharing that story, because I know how you've written it down lots and you've you've kind of spoken about parts of your story, but speaking through the whole journey that you've been through is sometimes just the most challenging thing. So thank you so much for being so brave, because I know there'll be women that listen back to your story and think, yeah, I remember that feeling. I remember sitting in the room with that doctor. So for them to know that actually they're not alone is just so powerful. It's just brilliant. So thank you.
Yeah.
So looking at, I guess the grief journey that you've been on is huge, and you were kind of grieving for what you thought Oliver's life was going to be initially, and then for that changing diagnosis, and then obviously him passing away. How have you kind of coped with that? Have you had any kind of, I know you spoke, you've got George's amazing support and kind of your parents and things, but has there been any kind of things that have really helped you to cope with your grief?
I'm not really sure how I coped. I think if I'm perfectly honest, I would say at the beginning, I didn't cope. I think it was a case of taking a day at a time and just going with the emotions that day brung. I remember getting home from hospital about midnight, the day after Oliver was born, and just sitting on the floor and messaging one of my closest friends who's a bereavement midwife. And I just said that I felt broken because I didn't know how else to describe it. I didn't know how to move, and I couldn't even work out how to get in the shower after 6 days in labour. And I couldn't stop crying. All I wanted was Oliver, but that was the one thing that I couldn't have. And that night I found the thought of falling asleep without Oliver just impossible. And so we actually both snuggled down into bed and watched numerous episodes of Location, Location, Location all night with patches of sleep when it wasn't possible to keep my eyes open anymore. I think I'd probably say the first few days were impossible, but somehow I did it. I cried almost any time someone asked me something. I think I even cried when George asked me what I wanted for dinner one night. I remember going back to the hospital a couple of days after having Oliver to register his birth and to see our amazing bereavement midwife, Steph, who has been amazing, and neither of us could have got through it without her. And I think it was then that it really hit us that not only was there the grief to deal with, but there were the physical things that we had to do. Like, we had to arrange his funeral and we had to register his birth. And I think dealing with that was almost the hardest bit, because until that, it was just us that we had to look after. But then suddenly there was something else to think about.
There's so many practicalities involved, isn't there, with the loss of a baby that don't even kind of come into your thought process until you're faced with them.
No, that's definitely
a really good point, because I think that's something that maybe people aren't aware of, is the fact that you yourself, so your body has gone through a 6 day labor and childbirth, which in itself is a massive thing to your body, but to have done all of that and to then obviously leave hospital without baby Oliver and to then have the emotional turmoil on top of it is just such a huge kind of battering to your body, isn't it, to go through. It's massive.
I remember in the early days when the community midwives came around, I'd just end up crying as soon as they asked how I was. I'm lucky that we had, after a few days, we got a consistent community midwife. So she visited us the whole time after her first visit. But I remember that another midwife had arranged for someone else to phone us just to check in that we were okay. And then she started the call with, "How's your baby?" And she was mortified that she hadn't realised what had happened, but it just completely broke me. And I literally couldn't say anything else on the phone because I didn't have my baby.
Yeah, and that's where continuity and communication is so, so key, because that event in itself can be hugely traumatic to you, as you said, because the last thing you want to do is have to keep repeating your story to a stranger. It's hard enough saying it once. So actually for people to have communicated that already is so important. And I really like to think, Josephine, in the maternity services, we've got things in place now that would prevent that happening. But I suppose there's always going to be that really unforgivable and unfortunate circumstance where these things go amiss, but that doesn't excuse it. Because that's a massive thing to you to receive.
Yeah, but she was mortified, bless her, and I almost felt bad for her because I didn't want her to feel bad that she'd made the mistake.
Yeah. Yeah, sure, it's a difficult one, isn't it? But that's where that continuity is so key, isn't it? And then I suppose, so you had the kind of support of your families and friends, and then your bereavement midwife, which I suppose was completely invaluable, because you really need that, don't you, when you're going through this sort of thing and you're so physically exhausted as you were.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. I think we were both just completely blown away with the support we received from people. From the moment we told them that Oliver wouldn't be coming home, we were just flooded with people offering us condolences and wanting to help. Our house was full of flowers and sympathy cards. I remember one person that particularly stands out in my mind was, we'd just moved house and we had to tell our estate agent because she knew we were expecting and it couldn't really be avoided. And a few days later, we just got an email from her about nothing else, just checking up that we were okay because she'd been thinking about us. And I think that really struck me because we'd known her a month, but she cared enough to check that we were okay.
That's really lovely, isn't it? Because you think, someone who doesn't know you. But I guess when we look at how common pregnancy and infant loss is, it's so likely that all these sort of people that perhaps you're not super close to have been affected in some way. And that's why we've got to start talking about it, because there's probably actually such an ample amount of support and women with shared experiences out there. But if we don't talk about it, then we don't know and we can't access it.
Definitely. I found myself sat in a traffic jam one day a few weeks ago, and I just sat there thinking, I bet I'm not the only person in this traffic jam that's just lost a baby. Like, it could be the car next to me or it could be four cars back, but I bet there's someone else.
Yeah, that's so true. And you're right when you look at the statistics around it. Like, you're absolutely right, for sure. And so I wonder, when we think about grief, and I know that your partner's called George, and everyone deals with grief in such a different way, and there's such a kind of spectrum, isn't there? And I know we spoke about some of the emotions, so obviously the sadness and the tragedy, but what I think is really interesting is that anger, almost, in terms of why us? We haven't done anything wrong. Why has this happened to me? And I think that's a really human thing to do, and it's kind of part of that natural grief process. But it can sometimes... I guess if one party in the relationship's going through one stage of grief and another's going through the other, it can cause some real challenges, can't it?
Yeah, I know that both myself and George have obviously dealt with it completely differently. And to me, George has just had it so together. And I've been sat there wondering, well, why am I the one falling apart on the floor, like unable to gather myself together to stand up? But I think... a lot of people have told me that men and women both grieve so differently. And I think for George, he's very much someone that likes the practical side of things that can be practically helped. So I know that all the sort of logistical arrangements with Oliver's funeral and things like that, I know that helped him and helped him to sort of begin his grieving process. But at the same time, I think I worry that there's a stigma attached that the men have to be strong for the women and that they're not allowed to be upset. And I think it's something that's really important to speak about, and just as important as the women, because I think if anything, the men possibly feel less, more alone in it maybe, and less supported.
I completely agree, Josephine. I think there's a stigma around pregnancy loss, for sure. And then the stigma around men is even more massive, I think, arguably. Yeah. Because like you say, it's and I think for some men as well, they feel like, well, it's not my body that's gone through that. So how can I feel sad when I need to support my partner? But recognizing that Oliver was both of your children and you'd both planned these memories for his life together. You know, you planned that to do these things as a family with him. So the trauma and the potential kind of mental health problems and grief for dad is equally as important for mums, but you raise such a good point, because we definitely don't discuss that anywhere near as much as we should. We're probably only just starting to scratch the surface, and when do have a tendency, not all men, I don't want to generalize, but sometimes a bit of a tendency to internalize these things. Definitely. And that can be really damaging in the long run as well, can't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Has your kind of bereavement team and bereavement midwives, have you had your meetings kind of together so that George has been involved in those?
So we had like the first few appointments together with Steph, our bereavement midwife. But it's had to be on the phone recently because of everything going on.
Yeah.
That's a bit more difficult to sort of do stuff together. But I've been really keen to encourage George that they're there for him as much as they are for me, and that they want to hear from him as much as they want to hear from me.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think what you're doing in terms of trying to get George really involved is so important. Mm-hmm. Because it's a massive journey for you both together as a family. But yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? It's so difficult, especially like you say, when people grieve in such dynamic ways. There's kind of no one size fits all support for anybody.
Yeah, definitely.
And I suppose with your kind of friends and family, Josephine, has anything kind of changed? Have there been any relationships that have perhaps come closer or more distant? And I suppose you've probably had to cope with maybe other friends and family going through pregnancies, which is a massive challenge.
So I think when we were expecting Oliver, some of our closest friends were expecting a baby in February and then in March as well. And then Oliver was due in April. And I remember being gripped with fear for them and terrified that they would lose their little ones as well. Because I think when you're thrown into the world of baby loss, you're just acutely aware of what can go wrong. So I remember feeling a huge, huge sense of relief when they all had their babies and they were okay. But I think one thing that really struck me was something I found more difficult than the actual birth of the baby was knowing that they were about to have their baby, because I never got that bit. And in a way, it was easier and a relief once they'd had their baby, and it felt that I could cope with that a bit better. But I think, I don't know, everyone on Facebook at the moment seems to be having a baby and seems to be announcing having a baby. And I think as time's gone on, those announcements have got harder, because as time's gone on, we've still not got our baby and our rainbow still isn't on the way. So I guess that is difficult to see those. But we're really lucky in that the friends that have had babies have all said that if we want to be involved, then they'd like us to be really involved with their babies.
Yeah, it's a challenge, isn't it? Because that's a complete human emotion, especially when they're your friends. And that's what you had planned, and that was taken away from you through absolutely no fault of your own.
Yeah.
So you kind of can't help but in your head think, well, why would that happen to me? Why are their babies okay? And as much as you are completely happy that your friends are getting on and having babies and pregnancies, and of course you're completely delighted for them, I think it's only natural that you have that kind of hint of, well, why is that not my situation? Yeah. And I don't want to use the term jealousy, because I don't mean that in a negative way, but I think it's a human comparison, isn't it?
Yeah, I found myself almost feeling angry that I feel jealous, because it's not so much jealous as in an anger jealous, but it's that should have been me, and it really nearly was.
Yeah, and it's not having those answers. Like, you obviously understand that Oliver passed away because of this condition that he had, but there's no answer as to why was it Oliver that had that condition. And that's just so hard, isn't it, to kind of comprehend. And so I totally understand. It's a non-malicious jealousy, but you can't help but feel that comparison, and that's just human, isn't it? And I know from speaking to you before, you're like one of the most compassionate people. So that would be a really sort of non-typical emotion for you to feel, which kind of exacerbates that anger and confusion, doesn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
So tell us more, Josephine, about your amazing blogs and your social media accounts. I know you're on Instagram, and the mission behind these really is just to raise awareness and celebrate Oliver's memory, so that you can try and kind of turn everything that's happened to you into a kind of positive momentum, I suppose.
Yeah. So I remember, I think it was a couple of days after we got home and my head was sort of a little bit clearer, I remember I used to listen to Giovanna Fletcher's Happy Mum, Happy Baby podcast. And I remember remembering that there was one that I deliberately, and it sounds awful, but I'd avoided it because I was almost scared if I listened to it, it would happen to me. And but I remembered that there was one with Elle Wright. And so I went back and found it and I listened to it. And I wish I'd listened to it sooner because I would have been so much more prepared. But it gave me, listening to her, it gave me such a sense of sort of relief that what I was feeling wasn't completely alien and it wasn't just me. And I went on to look at her Instagram as well. And that kind of just cemented that, yes, this is normal and yes, it is okay. And I think over the next few months, Elle's posts provided such sort of reassurance in a way that A, things did get easier, but B, that it was okay to not be okay. And so I think I felt that it was almost my duty to Oliver to use him to do something positive. So I thought, I remember messaging George's sister and saying, oh, should I do this? I've got this crazy idea. Is it ever going to work? And she's like, yeah, absolutely. Go for it. It'll be amazing. So I decided to go for the plunge and do it. And I just think it's so important that as much as you don't want to hear it when you're pregnant and you don't want to hear that it's a possibility, and to some extent you don't need to hear the full ins and outs of it, but I think it's really important that it's something that is on your radar, because then at least it doesn't come as a complete shock. And I think especially sort of if you put it in conjunction with the sort of Kicks Count campaign and things that will try and prevent it happening and the sleeping on your side and everything like that, I think it just slowly introduces it without necessarily throwing it in a pregnant woman's face, because you don't want to hear that when you're pregnant at all.
No, of course you don't. And it's not something that you should prepare for, because it's something we want to avoid.
Yeah.
But in the same aspect, I suppose, it could be that you're going about your normal everyday work and someone comes back into the office that's been on with bereavement leave, because we never know who we might come into contact with that's been affected. So I think it's quite useful for people to know perhaps how to start a conversation, because I don't know how you felt, but I know lots of people find it a bit awkward sometimes to start a conversation with someone that's lost their baby. And what you don't want people to do is avoid it, because then you think, you know what's happened. Why are you completely avoiding it? So has there been any things that people have kind of said to you that have been particularly kind of, I guess, good conversation starters or things that have been quite useful?
So I remember someone asked me my baby's name and how much he weighed. And I loved that, because yes, I'm not a normal parent, but I did have a baby. He does have a name and he did weigh something when he was born. And every other parent would be asked that question. And it just made me feel like someone's not completely separated me from the world of being a mum. Someone has still asked me a normal mum question. And it almost felt like just a giant hug.
Yeah, I love that. And that's such a powerful thing that anyone can do, is just say, what was your baby called? Did you have a boy or a girl? And how much did they weigh? Because every mum's going to know the answer to those questions, aren't they? For sure.
Absolutely,
for sure.
Yeah.
And that's so much better than a silence, because like you said, you want your baby to be recognised. You've still given birth to this beautiful little life.
Yeah.
And you want their memory to kind of be withheld. So that's an amazing tip. So to anyone out there who kind of is going to approach a conversation with someone that's perhaps lost a baby, that's an amazing, amazing little tip. And when we spoke about social media, so social media can be such a great thing and such a not so great thing. And and kind of like we spoke about, when you have suffered an infant loss, you tend to see pregnant people everywhere, don't you? Like everyone seems to be pregnant. And that's kind of the same on social media. And so I suppose it might be that you need to unfollow some account. I mean, you can't avoid pregnant people in the street, but you can unfollow certain accounts on social media that perhaps aren't quite right for where your head's at the time. And then, like you said, following people who make you feel supported, because there is such a wealth of support out there on infant loss, isn't there?
Yeah. I had never come across any of it, but there is so much out there, which I guess it's a shame it has to be out there, but thank goodness it is.
Yeah, most definitely. And recognizing that it's okay that one day you might feel good and feel happy, and that's okay.
Yeah.
And be going about normal things, or going out for dinner, maybe not at the moment with COVID, but generally doing these things, or meeting up with friends, or going on holiday, and that's okay. And then other days you'll feel like that awful, the whole world's caved in on you again. And that's a really normal roller coaster to go on, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the whole being okay with something is something that George really found, because everyone said it's okay not to be okay. It's okay to really struggle. But we both sort of, in the weeks between when we found out Oliver was poorly and we lost him, we both had sort of minutes, hours and days where we had better days. And I remember saying to the bereavement midwife, like, I feel awful. I've had an okay day. Like, I remember one day to distract ourselves, we went and brought Hoover, which sounds terribly boring, and it was, but it distracted us, and that was an okay day. And I remember her saying, no, that is completely normal. It's okay to be okay. And I think George has always sort of found that quite profound, and found it something that people need to understand, that as well as it's okay not to be okay, it is completely okay to be okay.
Yeah, definitely. And to go about those normal everyday things.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's really powerful, because I think quite often when you start to do something and you feel positive emotions again, you almost feel guilt. Well, how can I be happy when my baby isn't here? And again, that's a normal path to go through. But recognizing that actually you are going to have to go on with life, and Oliver's always going to be a memory, and he's always going to be your baby, and you're always going to be his mum. But you are going to have to go and buy a Hoover. You know,
that Hoover was needed.
It was needed. So, and the distraction's great. As much as we need to deal with the things that are going on in our heads, that day-to-day kind of going for a walk or keeping yourself busy or doing something different is a useful way of coping, isn't it?
Definitely. I think that's something I found. I think some days you definitely do need to wallow in your self-pity. You need to put a duvet on and you need to watch rubbish TV. But I also think there is massively a place for distraction, and I don't think it's necessarily just avoiding what you don't want to think about. I genuinely think it does help you to not come to terms with it, because I guess you never will, but to learn how to cope with feeling it.
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose in terms of the support network that you had, so you mentioned when you first got home and you told your loved ones about the news of Oliver, and everyone rallied around and sent you cards and flowers, and that's, I guess, really helpful in terms of helping you feel like you've got this amazing army behind you and you're not going through this on your own. But did that kind of dwindle as time went on, and how did you kind of find that?
I think we've been really lucky in that with our closest friends and our closest family, it hasn't dwindled. They've all sort of continued to rally around us, especially with the postnatal depression diagnosis. Like, George's work, again, have been totally amazing and have said he can work from home. Because I think I very much feel like I just fall apart when George isn't here, and I can't deal with my emotions, like the upset, on my own. So even just have him working upstairs and knowing he's there is such a support. And I don't think his work will ever know how much that means to me. But no, we've been really lucky with our friends. I think I had one friend who I was very, very close to. And since the day we told her Oliver was born, I haven't heard from her. And I think I find that really hard, because I think of what we had as a friendship, but then I understand that it's a conversation that no one wants to have. So I try not to dwell on it, but she is missed. But I guess you can't make everyone talk to you after something like this has happened.
Yeah, sure. But that's really hard, isn't it? And I guess that's where this stigma and fighting this stigma will hopefully help to stop that breakdown in friendships, because it's when you need people the most and you don't necessarily want people to be distant from you.
No.
Which is hard. And you mentioned during your story about the memory box that you started to create at the hospital. So that's for people who aren't familiar with memory boxes. They are a box, like it says, I guess, but very pretty and done up with ribbon. Yeah. And then inside, it's kind of like making as many memories as you possibly can in a really short period of time, because all these memories that you planned, the places you were going to take your baby, the pictures you were going to take have been taken away from you. So you've got this really concentrated short period of time to make as many memories as possible to help you really treasure your baby. So things like the hand and footprints that you spoke about, and casts and photographs, and was there like candles and trinkets and things like that in there as well?
I think we were just, I remember it was the night, I think it was like the fourth night that I spoke about something like that. I just had enough. I just wanted to meet him and I just felt so desperate. And I remember the midwife just came in with, she came in with the box from Lily May, and she came in with an aching arms bear. And it just felt like a hug from people that understood. And I know they're items and they're not feelings, but it was such a warm feeling inside to be given them.
And it's those memories that you make with them now, they are just so, so precious, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. They're the only memories we'll have with him, but they are the most special memories.
Absolutely. And do you mind talking a little bit more about some of the items that you've got in your box, Josephine, and whether you've kind of added to that, and perhaps where you keep it in kind of a treasured place?
Yeah. So at the moment, it's in our bedroom. We did have it in the nursery, but when we found out we were expecting our rainbow baby, we decided maybe it was time to keep him a little bit closer to us, but still keep him a massive part of the family, because he always will be, but his memories can't stay in a child's room because they are upsetting, unfortunately. And we both really hope that that nursery will be someone else's nursery one day. So yeah, at the moment it's kept in our room. I don't know if that's where it always will be.
Brilliant. And what's amazing is that you'll be able to use that to explain to his future brothers or sisters about their brother Oliver and their elder brother, and what he went through in his short life that he had with you, and what he was like and the memories you made and how brave that you guys have been as a result. And I've no doubt that they'll be full of immense pride when you eventually have those conversations, because, you know, they will come.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah. And have you added to the box at all from when you got back from hospital, or do you kind of plan to add any bits to it? Is there things that you sometimes see that kind of just remind you of him?
So between when we found out he was poorly and when we lost him, we brought an elephant, because elephants never forget. And it's a soft elephant and it's got his name on his ear. So that we've got that in our living room as sort of part of, we haven't got much up because we don't want to sort of upset people that come round. Obviously there's children that come round and you don't want to make anyone feel awkward. So we've got his hand and footprints and his elephant up in our living room and they sit together. So we've added the elephant. What else have we added? We've added the blanket that he was wrapped in. We were given, it was by another charity, and I feel awful because I can't remember the name and I've lost the piece of paper, but we were given it's like a blanket that was in two halves and it was tied together, and the baby has one half and then you keep the other half. So we've got that, and we brought him a pack of three sort of premature baby grows for him to wear. So we've got the other two that he didn't keep with him in his memory box as well.
Amazing. And they really are, to the charities that give us these memory boxes, are just worth their weight in gold, because
they're incredible.
They do provide you that incredible experience, I suppose, lifelong. What I find really interesting, Josephine, is how you mentioned there that you're worried about having things in your house in case people feel awkward. And I find that's really interesting, because I can totally appreciate how you feel. But I think that's where this stigma and this taboo is, it really needs changing, because there's no way that if you had Oliver at home with you that you would feel awkward about having things around the house. But because he isn't at home with you, you feel that emotion. And that really highlights, I think, how we just need to get the message out there, don't we? And get your voices out there and get rid of this kind of taboo and stigma and make people more aware.
Yeah, and I think that's something I've like, if you don't mind me going back to it, something I've felt with the postnatal depression as well. I think, I mean, in itself, it feels like a kick in the teeth that it's called that, because I haven't got my baby. And when you Google it, everything online and all the help is centered around like having people look after your baby and having a break and things like that. But I think, especially around the people that George told at work and the couple of friends I've told for support, I was really concerned what people would think about me. And I'm very much an advocate for speaking out and like being honest, and I want to be there to help people. But I found it really strange that I still found that I was worried what people would think of me. And it was completely unfounded. Like, so far, no one has thought I've gone mad or anything like that. But the worry was still there.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you are only human and you've been through such a tragic time. And it's kind of been, there's been lots of issues, hasn't there? Because you had that initial scan, then another scan, and then obviously the passing away of Oliver, and then a subsequent miscarriage that you spoke about. So all of those factors compounded together are too much for anybody, aren't they? That's just massive. And that's a massive life turmoil. So the depressive symptoms are going to come as a form of grief and things. And working through that, like you said, it's really interesting that so much of the information available is for those with a baby. And I can imagine you're probably thinking, well, if I had my baby, then I probably wouldn't have these depressive symptoms.
Yeah. And I remember George Googling, like, how can I help my partner postpartum depression after stillbirth? And even putting stillbirth into Google, nothing came up. I think there was the Tommy's website, which was great about sort of finding your diagnosis and speaking to your GP. But beyond that, there was nothing. There weren't any practical tips. And I know it's something he's really struggled with, because obviously, what I like to think he cares about me. But he's watching the person he cares about going through something, and there's literally nowhere to tell him what to do. There's no manual. There's nothing.
And I think, and with partners or men, they want to fix it, you know, so he wants to be able to fix you. And unfortunately, with the experiences you've been through and your diagnosis, there isn't a quick fix, you know. But the fact that there's no kind of tips and tricks and things that he can help with just alludes to the fact that there's just not enough awareness out there for the supports to be put in place.
Well, I didn't even realize you could get postpartum depression after a stillbirth. I assumed it was something that you had to have your baby for.
Yeah, which is really interesting, because actually, when you think of, there's obviously massive challenges caring for a newborn, but there's obviously humongous challenges with the experience you've been through. So it makes more sense that you'd be more likely to have these kind of depressive symptoms or mental health problems or birth trauma and kind of all of those terms, even kind of the post-traumatic stress spectrum. You know, there's such a spectrum of mental health that could be triggered by the sort of experiences that you've had. But like you say, you kind of associate it so heavily with a mum and a baby. So it's really interesting. And again, it was just that raising awareness. And that's why the voices of bereaved parents are just so, so powerful. But it's a really brave and challenging thing to speak up about. So your kind of social media and your beautifully written blog is just amazing. So to anyone who hasn't seen Josephine's Instagram account, and I think the link to your blog's on there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can you just remind me of the name? Because it's Little Footprints, isn't it, for your
Instagram? It's Precious Little Footprints with an underscore between the words.
So it is linked in the description of this podcast, so you can go and check it out. And please do go and read the blog, because it's just so brave and so courageous, and we need to get the message out there sort of as much as possible for sure, so that parents can have that support and not feel kind of marginalized, I suppose, by the support that's existing.
Yeah, because I think you do just feel so alone when you come home from hospital without your baby. I remember, so we've got a very close family friend who they tragically lost their baby a couple of years ago. And that was, other than my friend who was a midwife and obviously the obvious support, that was the only person I could think of that would possibly understand how it felt. And I sort of thought, well, how in a world where one in four pregnancies end in baby loss, is there only one person that I can think of?
That's really, and I wonder why, I don't know if you can shed any light, but why we are so sort of scared or concerned about speaking about pregnancy loss issues. I don't know whether it's maybe a stigma that you've done something wrong, which is absolutely never the case. But I wonder whether that's a reason. Have you kind of spoke to anyone else who's had any other kind of reasons why we're not happy to talk about it? I guess fear of judgment and...
Yeah, I think something both myself and George found actually was, in a way, we didn't want to make other people feel awkward about having the conversation, and we didn't really want to put people in a situation where they had to consider not bringing your baby home. But I think sort of as time's gone on, I kind of regret not opening up a little bit more at the beginning, maybe, because he was our baby, and obviously we didn't announce him in the traditional sense on Facebook that he'd been born and was crying away or whatever. But sort of a few months after we lost him, I think it was Mother's Day, we did actually put a post up, and we put a picture of his elephant and we put a picture of his footprint on it. And we just said that he'd been born sleeping and that today seemed a good day to say it. And the amount of people that came forward and the amount of people that just offered all manner of support and the amount of people that you don't realise have been through anything like that. And it kind of makes you think there's this, and I think to some extent quite right, secrecy around the 12-week thing, and that you then don't have to tell as many people. And obviously telling people is very hard, but to some extent, maybe if there wasn't that secrecy, maybe we would be more open as a society, and we would know who we can go to who's tragically been through it for support.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting that you say once you started speaking about it, so many other people started speaking. And that's, I suppose, the whole purpose of what you've been doing online and with your blogs, isn't it? Is to spark that conversation so that other people go, oh my goodness, yes, that happened to me. And then you've suddenly got this army of support around you that come from perhaps the most unlikely places. But together, you are able to really support each other in a way that people that haven't gone through that loss can't appreciate in the same way, I suppose.
Yeah, I think the problem is I know it's a horrible read, and I know it's a horrible thing to have to consider if you haven't lost a baby. But I just feel like, unfortunately, the statistics are that someone around you will have done, whether you know it or not. It could be the person you sit next to in the office, and it could have happened 20 years ago. But someone around you will have suffered it. And I think it's little things like, and I understand why, but there's kind of a resistance to share things amongst people who haven't lost a baby on social media about baby loss, because for whatever reason, they're not comfortable doing it. And I feel like that's possibly part of the thing that needs breaking down, because you've no idea who's looking at what you share on social media. And you could have a friend that you've no idea has been through it. He sees you share something, and that could just be the light at the end of their tunnel on a really desperate day.
Definitely. And I think there's definitely strength in speaking to people that have gone through the same thing as you. And I know that SANS, one of the amazing charities that works around their stillbirth and neonatal death society. So they work around all kind of pregnancy and child loss, and part of their support package is actually speaking to somebody who has gone through the loss themselves, isn't it? And because we recognize that having that in common is just such an immense kind of support and reassurance to you, especially when you meet with someone who is perhaps longer down the grief journey. And you can kind of think, well, actually, they've managed to go back to work, and they can go around Tesco without looking at every child and bursting into tears. Yep. So actually, I'll get there. Yep. And that can be a real support and momentum.
Definitely. I know. So my bereavement support worker, who is provided by a charity in the Midlands called the Lily May Foundation, Amy, she's tragically lost her baby with her partner. And that's when they set up the charity. And actually, it's been so helpful to hear someone say, yeah, that happened to me. Yeah, I was the one sat on the floor in like floods of tears unable to see a way out, but look where I am today, and it does get easier. And somehow it just feels more believable because they've been there.
Yeah, absolutely. And knowing that what you're going through is normal and it's all right, and it's not going to be like that forever. You know, you're not abnormal because you've got these emotions. You've been through one of the most tragic things that anyone could ever possibly imagine. And the emotions that you're feeling as a result are completely normal.
Yeah.
Amazing. And there is lots of other women out there feeling the same. We just need to get your voices out there so that they know that and they can reach for support.
Definitely. You need to get the conversation started.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I'm so grateful for you for so bravely doing that.
Oh, no problem.
So everyone that comes on my podcast, and I'm afraid you haven't escaped it, Josephine, I always ask for three top tips. So I wonder if you could share three top tips to bereaved parents that are going through their own infant loss journey, kind of regardless of where that is, I suppose, in a timescale, because it could be sort of the first days or weeks, or it could be 25 years later. But kind of what are your top tips to them, I suppose?
So I thought about this quite hard when you told me I needed to. There's so many things that I could have said. So I tried to pick out the three that sort of really got us through. So the first one is put yourself first. After our recent miscarriage, we got a card, which I actually posted on my page, which on the front said, take care of you, everything else can wait. And I think it's so true. I think if you don't look after yourself, then you'll never get through this awful time. And I think taking care of yourself can be anything from having a duvet day if you need one, watching box sets, to healthy eating and exercise and doing things you enjoy. And I think it's important to say that if you don't want to accept a social invitation, then look after yourself and say no. If it's not right for you to go and sit with your group of friends who have all got babies, you don't need to. You don't need to go to the baby shower. You don't need to do any of these things expected of you by society. And I think if you put yourself first, slowly, you begin to get there.
I love that. That's so, so important, because it's that being kind and looking after what you need. And every day is different. So like you said, one day it might be just cuddling up in your most comforting blanket. And the other day it might be going for a massive walk and getting loads of fresh air on your skin. And that's all right to do those things.
Yeah. So my second one I've put is reaching out and asking for help. And whether it's asking someone to cook you a dinner in the early days because it's too much, after all, everyone brings you food when you have a baby normally, or whether it's reaching out to sort of the GP or someone higher than that if you're struggling with your mental health, or asking to see friends if you just need a shoulder to cry on, or equally if you just need to have a laugh away from the world of baby loss.
Yeah, definitely. And I think sometimes people offer help and we kind of go, oh, no, it's fine. But actually going, do you know what? That'd be great. That would be really good.
Yeah, actually, yeah, I'll take that dinner that you've offered me.
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose for people that are listening who are supporting someone that's gone through infant loss is to maybe not even wait for that ask for help. Yeah. So drop a lasagna on the doorstep and just say, I'm here, I'm thinking of you. Or send that text, even if you don't get a reply, because for mums, just knowing that people are thinking of them is really powerful.
Definitely. Because I know so many people offered us food, but I think we kind of felt, oh no, like we have to do this ourselves. But I think if someone had dropped a lasagna around, we would have been so grateful and so sort of, oh my goodness, thank you. It's one thing we don't have to think about tonight. And I think I've had lots of those text messages of, are you okay? Just thinking of you. You don't need to reply. Just want to check in. And it's like a hug from the person when you receive it. And it does put a smile on your face.
Yeah, brilliant. Definitely.
So the third one I've got is, I kind of said it in the first one, you sort of touched on it, but take each day as it comes. Some days will be blooming difficult and feel totally impossible. However, at the same time, there will be better days, minutes, hours, whatever. And I think it's really important, as I said, to remember that while it's okay to not be okay, it is okay to be okay. And I think I didn't realise this until I said it to the bereavement midwife, I'm worried that I'm okay. And she said, no, you're allowed to be okay. You are still you. You have to have things that you still like. So I think it's really important to grab those times with both hands and really enjoy them, because unfortunately, realistically, they're not going to last that long, especially at the beginning. And you just need to enjoy what you can, because otherwise you will totally lose yourself.
Yeah, that's really powerful. And I know that they are, from my experience working with bereaved parents, that they are such massively common themes, either feeling like this is so overwhelming and I'm never going to get through it, or that thing of, but I laughed today. Like, how is that all right? So that's really powerful.
I laughed and I remember saying, that's awful. We've just lost Oliver. How can I laugh? And George was like, well, no, you're human. You will find things funny. You can't not laugh for the rest of your life.
Yeah, that's so, so true. And little Oliver wouldn't be wanting you to not laugh and enjoy these happy moments of life. So
yeah, definitely.
Josephine, I'm really, really grateful that you have come on and so, so bravely shared your story with yourself, George, and Oliver, because I know that it has been a massively challenging and tragic journey. But I am so thrilled that you are using your voice and your experience and Oliver's memory to really kind of raise awareness and provide massive support to other parents going through the same thing. So I honestly can't thank you enough.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to tell our story.
No, it's amazing. And it is an amazing story. And you are such brave and a courageous team. And I know that you will have lots of laughs in your future for sure.
Hopefully, yeah, definitely.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. I really hope that you enjoyed it. If you found it helpful, then please hit subscribe and leave a review. It really does make a huge difference to the number of women we can reach out to and empower. For daily free information, inspiration, or details on our bespoke antenatal education, head over to my Instagram page @midwife_pip. Thank you and see you next time.